I am Daniel Lickies.
And this is Mick, the Doctor of Digital.
And welcome to Music 101. Music 101 is created to empower music, music itself, and legendary icon in the music industry. Another week, another great episode. They wrote the hits. How pop, rock, and soul icons gave their best songs away.
Yeah, this artist episode was inspired by an article by Bennett Kleinman, who wrote an article entitled Music Legends Who Wrote Hit Songs They Didn't Sing. He says the world's most talented songwriters don't always end up performing the hit songs they write. Maybe the tune isn't right for the album they're currently working on. They're specifically hired to compose a song for someone else. Whatever the case, some tracks are handed off to a different musician and that version becomes a smash hit. So where we explore the fascinating stories behind the songs that shape popular music, and we're diving into one of the most intriguing aspects of the music industry, legendary artists who wrote massive hit songs that became famous in someone else's voice. From Prince to Willie Nelson, these songwriting geniuses created chart toppers that defined other artists' careers while remaining somewhat hidden in the shadows of their own legendary catalogs. World-class talents have all penned songs that became an indelible part of another artist's repertoire. Here's a look at famous musicians who wrote hit songs for someone else.
For someone else, definitely. So let's start with one of the most surprising songwriting credits in the 1980s pop music. Can you tell us about Prince and Manic Monday by the Bangles?
Absolutely. This is one of my favorite stories because it perfectly captures Prince's genius and generosity as a songwriter. Manic Monday hit number two on the Billboard Hot 100 in April 1986, and most people assume the Bangles wrote it themselves. The song was originally penned 2 years earlier by Prince, the same year he released the seminal album Purple Rain, which tells you just how prolific he was at that moment in his career. What's fascinating is that Prince originally wrote Manic Monday for Apollonia 6, an all-female trio he'd founded in 1983. He was planning to include it on their then self-titled album in 1984, but ultimately decided to leave it off. Fast forward to 1985, and Prince had become a huge fan of the Bangles' debut album All Over the Place, particularly the track Hero Takes a Fall. In conclusion, he was so impressed that he showed up unannounced at one of their concerts in San Francisco and jumped on stage to play a guitar solo with them. Can you imagine that moment?
Yes, definitely. Manic Monday is still, you know, echoing until now. Imagine how famous is Manic Monday. So that must have been incredible for the band. How did the song actually end up with their hands?
Well, Prince formally offered Manic Monday to the Bangles along with another song called Jealous Girl, which they wisely turned down. According to Bangles founder Susanna Hoffs, Prince presented the hit almost like a gift, and they immediately recognized its potential. Here's the kicker, though. Prince credited the song to Christopher, a pseudonym referencing his character from the 1986 film Under the Cherry Moon. He often used pseudonyms when writing for other artists, which created an air of mystery around his work. The song became a massive hit for the Bangles, peaking at number two in April of 86. But here's the most ironic part of the song that kept Manic Monday out of the top spot was Prince's own Kiss. So Prince literally blocked himself from having the number one song that week. The Bangles version was that perfect jangly guitar sound and Susanna Hoff's dreamy vocals that made it a defining song in the mid-80s. But you can still hear Prince's fingerprints all over the melody and chord structure. In conclusion, Manic Monday represents Prince's remarkable ability to write hits for any artist in any style and his generosity in sharing his genius with other musicians.
Yes, indeed. So can we do Manic Sunday, Mr. Mick?
Yeah.
Why not?
Why not?
Let's step back from the 1980s to the early 1960s and talk about Willie Nelson and Crazy, made famous by Patsy Cline. This is considered one of the greatest country songs ever recorded, right?
Without question, Crazy is Patsy Cline's signature song and her only top 10 pop hit, reaching number 9 on the Billboard Hot 100 in October 1961. But what most people don't realize is that Willie Nelson wrote it in his mid-20s before he'd ever tasted success as a performer. In the late 1950s, Nelson was working odd jobs and using his daily commute to write songs in his head. On one of those drives, he came up with Crazy in under an hour, though its first title was Stupid. The melody was unusually complex for country music at the time. As Nelson later told American Songwriter, it wasn't your basic three-chord country hillbilly song. In conclusion, with its four or five chords and jazz-inflected phrasing, the song didn't fit the Nashville formula, and producers kept turning it down.
Yeah, why is that? So, Mr. Mix, so how did Patsy Cline end up hearing it?
Well, that's where the story gets good. One night, Nelson brought a rough demo of Crazy to Nashville's Ryman Auditorium, where he happened to meet Patsy's husband, Charlie Dick. Dick loved the song so much that he drove Nelson to his house at 1 a.m. and woke Patsy up so she could listen. According to Nelson's 2023 book, Energy Follows Thought, The Songs and Stories Behind My Songs, Cline listened to that scratchy demo right there in her living room and instantly recognized its potential. She slowed down the tempo, gave it that aching, emotional quality that became her trademark, and transformed it into something timeless. The recording session wasn't easy. Cline was still recovering from a serious car accident and had cracked ribs, but she powered through and delivered one of the most iconic performances in country music history. Nelson later recorded his own version, but it never matched the magic of Cline's interpretation. In the end, Crazy shows that what can happen when the right song finds the right voice at that perfect moment. In conclusion, Willie Nelson's early brilliance needed an artist like Patsy Cline to bring its full beauty to life.
Well, indeed, crazy, crazy thing happened. So let's talk about one of the most magical pairings in pop history, the Monkees and Neil Diamond.
You couldn't get to script a better pop culture twist. The Monkees began as a TV experiment, not a band in the traditional sense. NBC launched the show in 1966 with four young actors playing a fictional rock group loosely based on the Beatles. The producers never intended them to be real musicians. Studio veterans like the Wrecking Crew played the instruments and professional songwriters provided the hits. But here's where art and commerce collided in the most American of ways. What started as a TV gimmick became a bona fide pop explosion. The Monkees sold millions of records, packed arenas, and briefly outsold the Beatles and the Rolling Stones combined. And right in the middle of that whirlwind was a young songwriter named Neil Diamond. In 1966, Diamond was hustling through New York's Brill Building scene, one of those cramped little offices where the walls practically vibrated with melody. He just scored his first top 10 hit with Cherry Cherry and was still trying to prove he could write something that would last longer than a summer. That's when Don Kirshner, the Monkees' musical supervisor, came calling. He needed songs that sounded like hits before the band even sang them. Diamond pulled out a demo he had written called I'm a Believer. It had that infectious gospel-tinged pop optimism that seemed to pour from Diamond's pen in those years, a hymn for the hopeful heart. The Monkees recorded it late that year. When it hit the airwaves in December 1966, it detonated. I'm a Believer became the best-selling single of 1967, a song so universally bright it seemed to make the radio itself smile. 10 million copies sold from Liverpool to Los Angeles. Kids were singing along to a tune written by a Brooklyn songwriter who just wanted his music to be heard. And that's the beauty of the story. When Mojo magazine asked Diamond years later if he minded that the Monkees version had outshadowed his own, he said something quite profound. I was thrilled because at heart, I was still a songwriter and I wanted my songs on the charts. That's humility and vocation rolled into one. Diamond understood something most artists struggle to accept. Sometimes the truest success isn't in being seen, but in being sung. In conclusion, the Monkees gave his song a voice, and he gave them a soul. It's a reminder that even in the most commercial corners of pop culture, grace has a way of sneaking through the cracks.
Mr. Meek, now here's one of the surprised me when I first learned about it. The Bee Gees wrote Islands in the Stream for Kenny Rogers and Dolly Parton. How did the Kings of Disco end up writing a country duet?
That's one of my favorite musical plot twists. On October 29, 1983, Islands in the Stream hit number one on the Billboard Hot 100 and stayed there for 2 weeks. This was Kenny Rogers' first chart topper since Lady and Dolly Parton's first since 9 to 5. And with this, the song wasn't written for either of them. That's the ironic part of it. It came from Barry, Maurice, and Robin Gibb, the Bee Gees, proving once again that great songwriting can slip between genres like light through stained glass. The story goes that Barry Gibb originally wrote the song for Diana Ross, or maybe Marvin Gaye, depending on which brother you ask. In a 2001 Good Morning America interview, Barry insisted it was meant for Ross, but Robin jumped in to say, no, Marvin Gaye. The truth's a little fuzzy. That's part of the Bee Gees' magic. Their songs had such flexible DNA that they could belong to anyone. In 1983, Barry was producing sessions for Kenny Rogers and brought Islands in the Stream along, hoping it would work as a solo track. But after 4 days in the studio, Rogers wasn't feeling it. He told Barry the song just wasn't clicking. Barry, being Barry, didn't panic. He looked around, thought for a moment, and said something like, what about Dolly? As luck, or providence would have it, Dolly Parton was literally downstairs in the same studio working on another project. Barry went down, asked if she'd be willing to try something, and a few minutes later, she walked into the room. The moment she started singing, everything changed. What had felt flat suddenly lifted off the ground. Roger's smooth baritone met Dolly's crystalline soprano, and the song caught fire. Part country, part pop, part something entirely new. You can hear the Bee Gees' touch all over it. That lilting groove, the elegant chord structures, the effortless modulation between joy and melancholy. And even carries a hint of Caribbean breeze, a reminder that the brothers Gibb were always global in their instincts, even when writing for Nashville. Islands in the Stream became more than a hit. It was a cultural unifier, the rare song that could play on a country station, a pop station, and at every karaoke night from Des Moines to Manila. And it did what the Bee Gees had always done best, blur boundaries until what was left was pure feeling. That's the secret of their genius. Whether they were writing disco anthems for the dance floor or country duets for the heartland, the Bee Gees wrote songs that outlived their moment. In conclusion, Islands in the Stream isn't just a crossover. It's proof that real melody never ages and that the truest pop music has always been about one thing, connection.
Connection, connection indeed, because we are truly, truly connected. Even the universe. So let's talk about the Beatles, Mr. Meek, influence on the other artists. Paul McCartney wrote Come and Get It for Badfinger, didn't he?
He did, and it's a perfect example of how the Beatles used their platform to launch new talent. Badfinger was the first band signed to the Beatles' Apple Records label in 1968, and their early success owed a lot to the Beatles' mentorship. Even their name traces back to a bit of Beatles lore. With a Little Help from My Friends was originally titled Badfinger Boogie because John Lennon played it with an injured hand, so the band quite literally took its name from a Beatles mishap. McCartney wrote Come and Get It specifically for the 1969 film The Magic Christian, which starred Ringo Starr. In conclusion, on July 24, 1969, during the Abbey Road sessions, Paul slipped into the studio and recorded a full demo, playing every instrument himself and singing all the parts. It's classic McCartney, tight, melodic, and instantly memorable.
Memorable indeed. Until now, it's still echoing, and I hope our generation will do like music like that. So, Mr. Meg, did he ever think about keeping it for himself?
Briefly, yes. He considered including it on Abbey Road, but decided instead to use it to help establish Badfinger as a credible rock band. He produced their session and even auditioned each member to determine who'd sing lead. Tom Evans got the part. The band wanted to experiment with the arrangement, but McCartney was adamant that they stick exactly to his demo, note for note. Some thought he was being controlling, but Paul knew precisely what made the song work. The taut rhythm, the urgent melody, and the unforgettable hook. If you want it, here it is. Come and get it. He was right. Released in early 1970, Come and Get It peaked at number 7 on the Billboard Hot 100 and stayed on the chart for 15 weeks, becoming Badfinger's breakthrough hit. It opened the door for later successes like No Matter What and Day After Day and positioned them as one of Apple Records' brightest hopes. In the end, Come and Get It shows McCartney at his best, generous, confident, and uncannily precise. He knew exactly how a song should sound and had the instinct to give it to the right artist at the right time. In conclusion, Badfinger got its start because Paul shared not just a song, but a vision of what great pop craftsmanship could achieve.
We talk about the several male songwriters, but let's discuss one of the greatest female songwriter of all time, Carole King. She wrote The Locomotion for Little Evan, right?
Absolutely. And this is one of the most joyful pop songs of the early 1960s. The Locomotion hit number one on the Billboard Hot 100 in August 1962 and stayed there for 1 week, becoming one of the defining dance songs of that era. Carole King wrote it with her then-husband, Jerry Goffin, and they were part of the legendary Brill Building songwriting scene in New York City. These were professional songwriters who would come into the office every day and write hits on demand for various artists. It was like a hit factory. What makes this story particularly charming is who Little Eva actually was. Her real name was Eva Narcissus Boyd, and she was Carole King's and Jerry Goffin's babysitter. She would watch their daughter while they worked on songs, and one day they heard her singing around the house and were struck by her natural, unaffected voice. In conclusion, she had this youthful energy and enthusiasm that was perfect for the teenage grand dance craze songs that were popular at the time.
Popular for sure. So they literally discovered their babysitter and turned her into a pop star.
That's exactly what happened. King and Goffin wrote The Locomotion specifically for Eva, and you can hear in the recording how perfectly her voice matches the song's playful spirit. The song is about a new dance craze, the locomotion, though unlike the twist or the mashed potato, this was a dance that essentially invented for the song. The lyrics are simple and encouraging. Everybody's doing a brand new dance sound. Come on, baby, do the locomotion. The production is classic early 60s pop with hand claps, a chugging rhythm that mimics a train and that unforgettable melody. The song was so strong that it charted twice more in later decades. Grand Funk Railroad took it to number one in 1974, and Kylie Minogue hit number three with it in 1988. Each version brought something different, but the original has this innocent, infectious quality that captures a specific moment in pop music history. Carole King herself rarely performed the song in her own concerts, preferring to focus on the more introspective material from her solo career, particularly her landmark album, Tapestry. In conclusion, The Locomotion shows how Carole King could write hits across the emotional spectrum, from deeply personal ballads to carefree dance songs, and how she discovered talent in the most unexpected places, even in her own home.
Unexpected places. So let's talk about one of the most covered songs in the music history, I always love you. Most people know Whitney Houston's version, but Dolly Parton wrote and originally recorded it, correct?
Yes, and this is a perfect example of how a great song can have multiple lives with completely different interpretations. Dolly Parton wrote and recorded I Will Always Love You in 1974, and it actually became a number one country hit for her twice, first in 1974 and again in 1982 when she re-recorded it for the movie, that movie that was The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas. The song was written about Porter Wagoner, who had been Dolly's mentor and duet partner for 7 years on his television show. When she decided to leave the show to pursue a solo career, she wrote this song as a bittersweet farewell. It's essentially a breakup song, but without any anger or bitterness, just pure gratitude and love for what they'd shared. Dolly's original version is tender and intimate, with minimal production, just her voice, some light acoustic guitar, and subtle strings. In conclusion, it feels like a personal letter set to music.
A personal letter indeed. Then Whitney Houston completely transformed it in 1992. How did that come about, Mr. Meg?
The Whitney Houston version is a whole different animal. It was recorded for the soundtrack of The Bodyguard, which starred Houston and Kevin Costner. Costner actually suggested a song for the movie, and producer David Foster created an arrangement that showcased Houston's incredible vocal range. The song starts with a Whitney singing a cappella, which immediately grabs your attention, then slowly builds with piano, then drums, then a full orchestral arrangement that becomes this massive soaring power ballad. It's one of the greatest vocal performances ever recorded. Houston versions topped the Billboard Hot 100 for 14 weeks in 1992 and 1993, becoming one of the best-selling singles of all time, with over 20 million copies sold worldwide. It won the Grammy Record of the Year award and became Whitney's signature song. What's remarkable is how different the two versions are. Dolly's is quiet and reflective. Whitney's is triumphant and powerful, yet both are equally valid interpretations of the same beautiful song. Dolly reportedly made millions from the publishing rights to Whitney's version, and she's been incredibly gracious about it, always expressing joy that her song reached such a massive audience. In conclusion, I Will Always Love You demonstrates how a perfectly crafted song can transcend its original context and find new meaning with different artists.
For sure, until now, Miss Dolly is still receiving the royalties.
Yes.
And finally, let's talk about Mr. Kris Kristofferson, or Kristofferson, and Me and Baby Maggie. This is forever associated with Janis Joplin, but Kristofferson wrote it, right?
He did, and this song has one of the most poignant backstories in rock history because Janis Joplin died 3 days after recording it. Me and Bobby McGee was written by Kris Kristofferson in 1969, and it became one of the great American road songs. Kristofferson was working as a janitor at Columbia Records Studios in Nashville when he was writing songs, trying to make it as a songwriter. The song goes about that Monument Records founder Fred Foster suggested the title after a secretary named Barbara McKee, though Kristofferson changed it to Bobby. The song is about freedom, movement, and bittersweet memories. It has that classic outlaw country feel, which lines like, "Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose." In conclusion, Kristofferson recorded it himself in 1969, and Roger Miller also had a minor hit with it that year, reaching number 12 on the country charts.
Yes, indeed. And Mr. Meg, finally, let's talk about Janis Joplin. Took another level entirely, correct?
Yes, you did. So Janis Joplin's version is absolutely heartbreaking when you know the context. She recorded it in October 1970 for her album Pearl, and just 3 days after finishing the track, she died of a heroin overdose at age 27. The album was released posthumously in January 1971, and Me and Bobby McGee became her only number one hit, topping the Billboard Hot 100 in March 1971. What makes her version so powerful is how she completely owns the song. First, she changed the gender. Christofferson's version is about a male narrator and a female Bobby McGee, but Janis flipped it so she's singing about a male Bobby McGee. This was actually quite progressive for 1970. Second, her raw emotional vocal delivery transformed the song from a country tune into a rock anthem. You can hear the joy and pain in her voice, especially on lines like "Freedom's just another word for nothing's left to lose, and nothing ain't worth nothing, but it's free." Knowing that she was dead within days of recording it adds this layer of tragedy. It feels like a fire farewell. Christofferson himself has said that her version surpasses anything he could have imagined when writing it, and that Janis owned the song completely. So when you think about songs that were hits for other artists, I have to mention, of course, All the Young Dudes by David Bowie, penned for Mott the Hoople, which became their breakthrough hit as well. So this happens. In conclusion, it's a terrific point to end this presentation with those cover songs that became hits for other artists when they were written. Me and Bobby McGee's represents how a great song can become immortal when performed by an artist who fully inhabits its emotional landscape, and how Janis Joplin's tragic death ensured that this song would forever be remembered as her final gift to the world.
And Mr. Meg, thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and wisdom to the world. Yes, people, the road, the heat, how pop, rock, and soul icons gave their best songs away explores the fascinating world of legendary artists who penned masterpieces, not for themselves, but for the others who turned those songs into global sensation. So, Mr. Mick, would you like to plug in something?
Sure, I appreciate the opportunity. Write the book, grow the business. Connect with me, G. Mick, the Dr. Digital Smith, PhD, on LinkedIn. Listen to the podcast, the Dr. Digital Podcast, and pick up a couple of volumes I have on Amazon. That's Burning America and On Track Ian Hunter. And speaking of music, support True Fans. They are doing some revolutionary work for artists all over the world in music.
Yes. Indeed, let's support Mr. Meg, the Dr. Digital, and please do listen to our baby podcast, Mental Health 101. Mental Health 101 is created to empower our mental health awareness. So, Mr. Meg, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, my friend. Till next time, Deus vult.
More to come, people. See you soon.